Welcome to New Lens with Comma Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within the different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I think everybody knows I'm Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Comma Good Capital. I'm here with Sharon Beach, and we met, let's just say, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I think, because of a common interest in agriculture and farming, which we'll get to here in a second. And then Sharon, and I think I've got this right, is the CIO of Empire Ag, or I guess technically it's EA Capital Management. Is that what you're the CIO of?
That's correct. I'm founder and CIO.
Okay, wonderful. But in the meantime, as I've gotten to know Sharon, besides just fascinating what you're doing in that space, we were chatting, and as everybody knows, probably who's listening, I have a deep passion for men and women who are incarcerated. But Sharon was so bold to be vulnerable and shared part of her story, and she was unfortunately a victim, 2 or 3 men. And so I thought, man, besides who you are professionally, but just to hear where you're at today in light of this horrible scenario, it's just a great reminder. As much as I believe in these men and women behind bars, but we should not forget that there are victims on the other side. And in fact, those inmates who care, contrary to what some might think, they do care about. Now, not everybody, but I've been in prisons where it is something that's very near and dear to them, and they wish they could change it. So anyways, long intro, but Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So, okay, we'll see where this thing leads, which is half the fun. Why don't you just give us a little overview of your life, kind of like, you know, where were you born, where you grew up, and then what you've done from a career standpoint. I'm assuming we'll touch then at some point on what you shared with me about your past.
You bet. I feel like I should give you my name, serial number, and you know, bad, possibly so. But you can tell from my accent, I'm Texan. I am a native Texan. Grew up in Texas A&M University, then started a career outside of that. Worked in the feed industry for years. I was actually in the pharmaceutical business for 25 years on both the animal health and human health. And then, probably about eight, 9 years ago now, I had the opportunity to go into private equity, which led to me going into partnership with a firm that I stepped away from last year. So, and then I learned that semi-retirement was not for me. And so then I met the Harrelsons, which brought me to Empire Ag and EA Capital Management, where I am today, agriculture-based, helping farmers, our true family-owned farmers and ranchers who produce the food that we eat every day and consume. So that's just a little bit of overview. Unfortunately, single, divorced, no children, but I have a lot of four-legged children, as I say. I'm very active with my horses. I have cutting horses, very active with them. Have a small farm where I produce hay, keep my horses. So all those things keep me busy. And I have a lot of children that aren't blood related, but they're still my kiddos.
So thank you for that quick overview. So what are you doing right now from a business perspective? And then I'm curious, I mean, you're from Texas, I may hear a bunch of stuff, but why are you so passionate about what you're doing today?
I'll answer those questions in reverse order. Passion about agriculture. I tell you, sometimes God just puts something in you and you're blessed to have that passion. I've been told before, you're blessed, at least you know what your passion is, because these horses are like a disease. If you don't have one, you're not happy. So, and God put me in the right state. I said, I'm just sort of I'm a nerdy Texas cowgirl. I love all things Western, all things cowgirl, which leads to agriculture. You know, we have our ranchers. I'm more knowledgeable the ranching side of our farmers and ranchers versus our row crop producers. So it's just a passion. And I have to share with you, I actually saw a comedian last night, and she's from Knoxville, Tennessee. And she was in Texas. She goes, I don't know what it is about you Texans, but y'all are passionate and you're tough. And if the world ever goes to hell in a handbasket, I just want to know if I can get to Texas, because y'all will take care of yourselves. And so we do have a deep passion for the love for our land, the love for the cowboy way of life, in the Western spirit. And so whenever I thought I wanted to semi-retire and I wanted to get back into doing something and being active, I'm like, you know what? I have the golden wand in front of me. I left agriculture as my career in 2002. And I had the opportunity, like, I want to go back to agriculture. That's the first thing I want to do. And then I have some different avenues I was interested in, which led me to where I am today when I met Jonathan and Holly Harrelson, who are founders of Empire Ag as well as Empire Financial Services. And what I loved about what the Harrelsons have done with Empire Ag is they've let it organically grow. They didn't meet me and say, oh, let's just go form a private capital management and offer private credit funds and let's just go do it. We actually were fulfilling a need that they have built over the past 5 years. They've seen the need. They hear it every day from the clients they have in the consulting arm across 22 different states, or it might be in their Empire Financial Services division. And so it was, we say it was a blessing. It was sort of maybe a plan by God that we came together when we did. And so that's what I'm doing now, is I'm working with Empire Ag in the EA Capital Management division, which is the third division of the company. I was my founder of that division as well as CIO, and we are offering private fund direct lending investment opportunities for our investors. And then those funds are being deployed into Empire Ag established clients only, because we feel if we're going to invest in you by offering you a loan, then we want you to invest in yourself to help us help you run your operation, whatever it may be. We have everything from a 6-acre popcorn farmer to somebody runs thousands of head of cows on an annual basis. But whatever your individual operation is, we're not cookie cutter, and we drill down to what your needs are. So that's a little bit of what I'm doing right now and how I got there.
So I think we've talked about this. We're doing some stuff in the regenerative agriculture space, which is pasture land as well as farmland. Do you do much in that? Do you focus on that? I'll just stop there and ask that question and give me your thoughts on that.
As far as this, do we individually do it? Maybe Jonathan does in his operation. I know that I do everything I can to make my grass as productive as possible, as well as the nutrient value for the people who buy my hay. But then from our point of view, if you're a successful operator, whether it's ranching, whether it's row crop, whatever it may be, and you're successful and you've been at it a long term, you're doing regenerative agriculture anyway, more than likely, because that has to, and we've just begun labeling it, whether it's regen, whether it's sustainable, those people have been doing it. They're the ones that are making sure we have ample water supply for their animals. Let's use what nature gave us and then add to it. And so do we talk about it every day? Do we label it? Probably not. But we talk about it because we want our producers implementing the best practices, up-to-date technology, using drones for spraying, if that's the more advantage for whatever they may need to do. So we do talk about it. We just don't label it. We just don't say, hey, come and talk with us. We're going to talk about regen and sustainable practices. We're helping you implement what your need is and what the best practices are for your operation.
Okay, one last question specific to this. What is the farmer facing? I mean, obviously, you're trying to serve the farmer. What's the problem? How are you guys? And again, this is not an investment pitch for anybody listening, but the psyche of the farmer and what are their issues right now?
Well, one of their issues, of course, which is first and foremost for me, is the access to capital. That barrier is getting bigger and bigger. The wall is getting taller, however you want to look at it. That is becoming tough. And they do work on an operating line of credit, just as many businesses outside of the agriculture sector work in the United States. Then there are factors that we can't control. Development of land. We're losing agriculture producing land on a daily basis, whether it's from our incentives, whatever it may be. It's more people moving in to producing areas where we have houses being developed. It's also land at a reasonable cost. One of the biggest problems right now we have in agriculture is young people cannot get in. You cannot afford. It is absolutely unreasonable to think that you can go and buy land and pay for the land from the operation that you want to run. So we, in fact, in Empire Ag, we're trying to figure out how can we get young producers with older producers who want to retire, but the kids don't want to run the operations. They don't want to sell the land. They like to play farmer or hunter 5, 6, 7, 8 times a year. So let's find a way to get the young people in who do want to and keep that land in production. That's some of the biggest barriers and problems that we see. We can talk about prices. We can talk about what they're getting for their prices. We can talk about beef cattle inventory, but those things are seasonal. Sometimes we have to go counter seasonal, but those are seasonal. But what the true concerns are today, we feel like those are what is truly facing the agriculture producer of the United States.
So what's interesting here in the state of Florida, and I think I'll get my numbers right, but about 1 billion pounds of produce or vegetation, whatever, you know, plants and whatnot, get left in the fields every year. So there's a group here in Orlando called Four Roots. And part of that is to try to gather as much as it can, distribute it to schools and people who need it and whatnot. But then the other thing, just related to what you said, is that so they've actually created a working farm, not in downtown Orlando, but almost downtown in this 40 acres. And part of it is to capture all that. The other part is to actually train and bring back farming into the schools and education, because it's just hard. Maybe it's different in Texas, but in Florida, farming is probably not top of mind for people to learn about. And so it's been real interesting to see how they're trying to create this avenue, this location for people to see it. It's a working farm. They're using food as medicine, bunch of things. So I mentioned to you that if you ever come to Orlando, I think you'd love to see it. But it does resonate that we have a skill set historically in America, and it, passing it on is going to be really, really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just like in Texas. I'm pretty sure this is the figure, give or take a little bit. But in 2024, we lost 852 acres daily from producing agricultural land. We lost that. And you add that up year after year. You're losing all. In Abilene, Texas, which is 2 hours west of me, we've lost 10,000 acres of cattle producing land this year because of two data centers coming in. So you're exactly right. So then we lose that, then we lose the knowledge because our local communities go and have other sources of revenue besides agriculture. So we do lose that knowledge. So I know a gentleman that he is actually taking in Oklahoma. He's taking 7,000 acres, putting it in a foundation, and then forming a school so kids can come out to that ranch and they will learn to hunt, fish, gather, garden, as well as prepare the food. He goes, these kids, I want them to know where, first of all, take care of themselves. But then if they need it, they have a food source and the ability and the skill set to actually produce it or go gather it or hunt it for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the state of Oregon. So, you know, farming and that kind of stuff was really in my backyard. But I can remember being on flights in the last 10, 15 years. And literally, I was sitting one time next to a guy and he was flying around showing homeowners how to have a garden. And it's just like, wait, people don't know how to have a garden? And they don't.
They don't. Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. You can grow one in their backyard. It can be very small and still produce something.
So it's funny, here in Orlando or outside of Orlando, and my wife, we literally have a little raised garden. It's not very big. Our peppers this year, it's amazing how many peppers this thing kicks out. But it's actually, I mean, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, but seeing where your food is produced, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, makes a difference. Yeah. It does.
Okay, so philosophical and a practical question, you can answer however you want. How would you best describe who you are today in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
Oh my goodness. How would I describe myself today? Grounded. I would say grounded. Happy with where life is. Content. I always try to find joy in whatever circumstance comes into my life. Looking forward to my future still. Looking forward to things. But I'm not one to sit around. So
let me jump in here because you shared, I don't even remember how it all came up. It doesn't really matter. But you shared a horrible scenario that, okay, if you want to bring that, you can. You mentioned a horrible story about what happened to you. And I'm curious how that experience has shaped, I mean, obviously, how it shaped you today with what you're doing and who you are today. And to the extent you feel comfortable sharing a little bit, that'd be great.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. No, I remember exactly how the conversation took place. We jump on a call and your first question is, are you a person of faith? I'm like, absolutely I am. And I'm like, good for you. Being bold enough to ask that question.
That's
like,
awesome.
I really like you. Yeah. So that's great. But yes, the adversity I went through, how it has shaped me today is I enjoy life. Because life can be taken from us in any moment. Unfortunately, I am an A personality and I run hard and get stressed out, but then I'm thankful for each day. I wake up each morning with a heart of gratitude. And if I don't, I remind myself really quick that, hey, here's another day and a day where we can go and fulfill whatever the good Lord has purpose for us that day. Compassionate, how I have compassion. I want to help others. Go above and beyond, have a little bit of that servant heart. I think that actually was instilled for me from one of my grandmothers as well. A little skeptical, be very honest with you. It's caused some skepticism in my life as well, but it's also led me to a much stronger faith in God and knowing that He will take care of me and I'm not scared to death.
When you say skepticism, because I know your story a little bit, and so I'd love to hear why you say skepticism, because I also, the word that comes to my mind would be distrust, mistrust. Are those the same things in your mind? Or
that's the same thing.
Got it. Well, do you mind sharing what happened high level? I mean, you can go into depth, but I don't want you to divulge anything you don't want to, but because you are writing a book on this too, so.
I am writing a book, and if I may, I'd like to share that journey a little bit. So what I'm getting ready to share actually happened to me when I was 26 years old. And so that would have been 36 years ago now. And for years, people were like, this could be a movie. You need to write a book. And I did try one time. I think it was in 97. And you just can't force some things to happen. You just can't do it. Went on, live life, you know, and then all of a sudden, bigger than Dallas. We say that here in Texas. Maybe I shouldn't say that on bigger than Dallas. God said, it's time. Get after it. And he opened the doors like he parted the Red Sea for me to start writing my book. And I just finished signing my publishing contract with Forbes. And I spent 2 weeks getting everything out of my heart and my head for my book. And so I've been trying to follow the good Lord. He said, it's time. Everybody has a story and get after it. And so here I am today. So hopefully the book will be out probably next spring sometime, but I've been on a number of podcasts, speaking in a number of places. More speaking engagements are coming to me because I am willing to share my story and I can get up and share. But my resiliency and my faith was truly tested in October of 1989. I was kidnapped and held hostage for 4 days. They took me, captured me on a Sunday night. I was actually going, and I knew one of the perpetrators. There was two of them. And I was going to pick up a horse. And to this day, I don't know why they kidnapped me, but they did. After the first night, when I woke up the next morning, I prepared myself for death because those situations usually end up in death. And I just talked to God for about 2 hours. And after that, I'm like, okay, now let's get going. We got to get me out of here. And so as somebody said, that you just went into psychological warfare is what you did. And I did play games with them. And I would push and I'd back up. I'd push a little bit more and I'd back up. They hauled me to another place in Texas, you know, kidnapped me in one place. The sexual assault took place. Ended up in another town where they kidnapped another person when we got to that town. And then I finally escaped from them on my own accord on a Thursday night. So they had me from a Sunday night to a Thursday night, and I was able to escape. Most unfortunately, for the next 2 months following that, I became sick, and I was just getting more ill and more ill with nausea and diarrhea. And I went to 3 doctors, and because my blood did not show any infection, they all told me it was mental. I was making myself mental. You've never experienced what you just went through, and it was all mental. And so finally, after, of course, this is the holiday season, Thanksgiving and Christmas. And so after the first of the year, and let me back up, I stayed with my mother and my sister so they could care for me. And so after the first of the year, I'm like, maybe it is mental. Maybe it's time for me to go back to my house, try to get back to life. And so I did go back to my home. And that first day I called my sister, I said, I can't, I am balled up in a fetal position. And so they got me back to my little hometown, 5,000 people where we were raised, and my mother lived it until we lost her. And the doctor there, my mother's primary care doctor, said, I refuse to give you any more medication for pain, because he was at least helping me control the pain. He goes, there's something wrong someplace. And so from about noon or 1 o'clock that afternoon, within 12 hours, I'm in downtown Dallas going into emergency surgery. And they had found what was wrong. And the surgeon that my mother actually grew up with, a surgeon, he was one of the number one surgeons in the state of Texas at the time. And they just happened to grow up together in Dallas. And whenever he went to visit with them before he started working on me, he goes, I'm just going to tell you right now, this kid's got a 50-50 chance of coming out of here. And her body is probably about 5 to 6 days from expiring. That's how sick I had become. And so anyway, so needless to say, I did make it through the surgery. And then I spent the next 5 months in the hospital fighting for my physical life. And one time I had 12 catheters hanging off my body, draining infection, because what the problem is I had been sodomized with a foreign object, which made a tear in my rectum. So from that night until they found the problem, waste had been leaking in my body, which called peritonitis. And so that had just eaten my body alive. So that's why I had the 12 catheters, because they couldn't clean it out. That first surgery, they cut me open. They put everything they could internally and laid it to the side and started cleaning me out. They just finally had to put me back together. And then we just fought the infection, that 5 months till I was able to, I did overcome it and finally go home. So you can just imagine the medical stories I have. But yet we always find a little humor along the way. When I was in ICU after I came out of the first surgery, because I had 2 more major surgeries while I was in the hospital up 5 months. And so while I was in ICU the first time, I just wanted something, and I couldn't have anything by mouth. I couldn't have anything orally. So my older sister, my only sister, was an angel. She was almost able to stay with me 24 hours a day during those 5 months. She would come in and give me a sip of Dr. Pepper and let me swish it around and spit it back out. So we had a laugh over that. She goes, but if you ever swallow it, you don't get any more. Never would swallow it, because at every 3 or 4 hours she was allowed to an ICU to visit, I just savored that cold Dr. Pepper. The thing about it is, while I was in that 5 months, they finally realized they needed to assign nurses to me that knew my case, instead of having new nurses come on shifts and everything. And so you built friendships. And I had a couple of nurses, they would get so tired of their other patients, they'd come in my room for relief because we'd find a way to make them laugh in some form or fashion, you know? And I was blessed. If I didn't get seven, you know, we didn't have email and cell phones back then. And so I'd get 7 to 10 greeting cards in the mail a day at the hospital, knowing I was being prayed for. You know, there were people that prayed for me that I will never meet that. And it was by the power of prayer. I had a family in Ohio who I knew one of the children. And then I finally got to meet the family after I got back on my feet. But there's 9 siblings. So there was 10 households. So I had 10 candles burning 24 hours a day as a reminder to pray for me until I came out of the hospital. And so you have support out there that you just never dream of. So anyway, so I came out of the hospital, got back to going with life, and then the justice system and the legal battles kicked in. And we could sit here for 2 days and talk about that. I don't have faith in the legal system. I want to, but I don't. And here in Texas, we have the Texas Rangers, not the baseball team, but the Texas Rangers. And I finally had to go to them to get help. Victims have to fight for themselves because they become victims again in the justice system. And I made a deal with my perpetrators. When your life is in your hands and you've had a pistol stuck in your mouth and you don't know if they're going to pull the trigger, I'm like, you let me go. They had my dog. They were in my truck and trailer. I said, you let me go and I will not press charges. And in the cowboy way of life, we take our word seriously. So it took about 3 or 4 days for people. And we found out that my perpetrators were on parole. Both of them had already been in prison twice and they were on parole. And so then one conversation led to another and their parole officers call and say, you have to press charges. So I agreed to. And so they said, go to where the sexual assault, go to that county first in Texas to press charges. And so I walk into the sheriff's office and they meet me outside. They're aware that I'm coming and that I want to press charges. And the first question I'm asked by that county sheriff is how you were dressed. And I will not repeat my answer on a podcast, but you can imagine. And then,
good for you for answering that way.
And then they asked me to write a statement of the last 4 days that I was kidnapped. After about 30 minutes, they came and checked on me. They're like, are you okay? And I'm like, yes. And they're like, do you need anything? I'm like, no. And they said, are you done? I'm like, no. I said, I'm on page 25. And you've asked me. And they said, really? And so make a long story short, they said most victims only write maybe half a page statement. Mine ended up being 45 pages handwritten.
Wow.
I said, you're dealing with somebody who has their master's from Texas A&M and went through a thesis and everything else. So you asked for detail and here it is. And then they lost it, my handwritten statement. So then I had to go to the county of origination of crime. And then before you know it, luckily I had friends with fathers as Texas Rangers. And that's where my help came from. Once the Texas Rangers got involved, things started rolling. So I was a victim again and having to fight the legal system. So anyway, so I finally got them put behind bars so they couldn't hurt anyone else. But the one that I knew made a plea bargain and he got out on mandatory parole 10 years later, almost broke some Texas cattlemen during the drought by saying he had pasture for lease and he'd take the cattle and sell them. He got in prison for that. He got out again. And then he escaped from a county jail and victimized 6 other people. And I was surprised witness in 2 of those. And then the second judge said, we're done. And he ended up with 12 life sentences. So anyway, so my legal battle could go on and on, but that's like a snapshot of the type of perpetrators and what they did to me and the legal battle I had to fight along the way. And then I fought health problems for 20 years. In 2011, I finally feel like I got life back. And so that would have been, 14 years ago. So I was in my late 40s, early 50s. So I feel like I miss my 30s and 40s. So that's why I live so hard today. Mm-hmm. As in, I have some dear friends or kids have those self-balancing Segways. And I'm like, you know, I've got to learn to ride one of those. But I broke my leg due to a horseback situation in April. And I was talking to my orthopedic guy. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to get one of those self-balancing Segways. That's great for old people, for balance and core strength and everything. He goes, Mr. Beach, don't you dare. People your age are not supposed to ride those. Well, I ride mine all over the pasture and every place now. So anyway, I live life to its fullest because life was so precious to me because I almost lost it. I almost lost it while they had me. I didn't know due to the medical problems and being in the hospital 5 months whenever I didn't know. For sometimes it was literally, we made it through that next breath. We made it through that next hour. We made it through the day. I can eat. I actually want something to eat. You know, we made it through that week. Oh, I can get up and walk around now. So life is precious. So I live it full blast now that I have health problems back because my body was so riddled with infection, is so much scar tissue is in my body that it just took its years to heal. I mean, and just numerous intestinal problems after that, weight gain, weight loss. Then I was ultimately diagnosed with Crohn's, had to have tissues of my intestines removed from that. Ended up with an emergency hysterectomy because they thought I had ovarian cancer. It wasn't. It was a result of what had happened to me, and I had fluid-filled pockets around my ovaries. And so just one thing after another, and then I developed a diathyroid lesion where my hemoglobin just remained in the 8 to 9 range, and I could barely function on a daily basis. And luckily, I had a GI find that lesion. He cauterized it, and it's been 100 miles an hour since then. So for 20 years after that, I fought health problems. And so you can see there's a lot of lessons and a lot of things to be taken. And then all of a sudden, God said, it's time. It is time for you to go tell your story. And so here I am. There are people that have known me for 10 years that didn't know what happened to me. I don't tell my story or share my story out of sympathy or empathy. If it comes up, great. If I can help someone, that's the only thing I want to do by sharing my story is to help others. Maybe they've had trouble overcoming their trauma, but if I can share my story and how I overcame my trauma to the point, the last chapter in my book is going to be how loved ones can help victims from my point of view, as well as include some resources out there from victims' organizations. Because sometimes it's not what you think. Just come and just be with us. Just be present. Just be there. You may not say a word all day long, but anyway, I can go off on that too.
Well, first of all, thank you.
God telling me to go share your story. And then people will find out they've known me for 10 years. Like, what? You got to be kidding me. You went through that? You would never know it about because of your attitude in life. I said, absolutely, because living well is the best revenge. I can't help that.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that and the vulnerability. Although you seem like vulnerability, you've got that conquered, which is, I mean, such a testament. I mean, part of the reason why I wanted people to hear your story is to see how you are today. And you've used it. And clearly it was a battle. But I mean, you're not asking for any sympathy or handouts, or it's like, you're going to go conquer the world to do what God's called you to do. So I think that that's powerful. The other thing is, you know, given my background on the side doing stuff with inmates who've been incarcerated, it's such a great reminder that there's a victim on the other side. And well, I'm going to ask you a question. It's a sensitive question, but I think I have a sense what you'll say. Do you think that people can change? I mean, do you think those guys, whether they've changed or not, can guys like that change?
Do I think inmates can change?
Yeah.
Yes. Guys like what they did to me? No. But do I think inmates can change? Anybody can change. Just like anybody can survive most anything. I survived this. So that's the hope I want to give people. Whatever it is, time does a lot for you. Time does a lot for inmates. Maybe they did it when they were 18 years old, and now maturity has helped them change. So yes, I do believe they can.
Okay. I do not know how to make the transition back to agriculture, but I'm going to do it. But again, that's powerful. And I'm anxious to read your book. Before I move on, one question. If you had one piece of advice for somebody or the main purpose of the book, what would it be? If there is a main idea or main purpose?
Don't give up. Don't give up. Whatever you're fighting is temporary.
Okay. Well, let me switch over because you just have such a unique perspective and you've been through so much. So I'm going to ask you this question and you can answer however you want, but maybe I'm going to try to direct you, but if you want to answer differently, you can. In light of what farmers are going through or faced with, when did you realize the power of capital? So that could be any time in your life. And what does that mean to you?
When I actually realized the power of capital, I would say probably during my college years, I realized that and the power that it has to change people's lives. And that's when I realized it. And then whenever I had the opportunity to be in the first investment firm I was in, that, of course, it became even stronger. But what I love about the power of capital now is I feel like I'm doing something for the greater good. I'm just not going out there making our investors a dollar. I'm actually having an impact on somebody and their life. That is what the power of capital can do. And I saw it as an early age because I came from a broken home. I had to put myself through college, started working when I was 10 years old. And always there were things in life I wanted. And I knew you had to have the capital. So I figured out how to get there. And then I surrounded myself with people who were smart enough and who had the wisdom to help people get there. But then that now it all comes together in what I want to do to help people. I love to help people. I'm a very giving person. I don't want to tout that. It's not like I'm bragging, but that's what people about me that I'm a very giving person. And now this is just so much fun because not only are you doing well with your investors, but man, you're changing somebody's life and you're making a true impact in their life.
Why are you so generous?
Why not? If we don't take care of each other while we're on this earth, why are we here? And people are selfish these days.
It's a very simple answer, and I love it. Okay, my last question for you. If you could make one dream come true for your life, what would it be?
That would be married with children.
Now that's a vulnerable answer.
It's a little past that stage. I can still get married. I can have stepchildren. But that is a dream of mine that did not come true.
Wow.
I was married, but married for 10 years. But for reasons, didn't have children. But that is a dream that I would have loved to have come true.
So I have a daughter who's soon to be 24. She is she's graduated in the midst of applying for nursing school. And we'll find out when and where she gets in.
And I'm going to interrupt you and say, thank God for that, because it's the nurses that kept me alive.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. Well, so what I wanted to ask you is, what would you say to an almost 24-year-old who, look, she's balanced, but she also would love to be married and have kids someday. But at times is like, yeah, but there isn't anybody. There's no good guys anymore. What's your answer to a 23, 24-year-old?
Well, I mean, there's much different than the answer I would give myself. It's become involved. Whatever it is you want to become involved in, you do have to get out and meet people. Prince Charming's not going to come to the front door. You know, so become involved, associate, be active in your community, wherever you are, and then pray first and foremost, because God has a purpose for our lives and he will fulfill and bring you what you want when you least expect it.
And I think that is a great way to end it with you, because this is coming from a woman who believes that God's got a plan for her, your life, and yet you had to go through some horrible crap, and you still can say that. That's impressive.
God's on my side.
It's people like you that I want on this podcast, people who aren't just talking about doing stuff, but they're risking for the sake of others. That's what you're doing. So that is so cool. And I hope that the farmers that benefit from the capital that you're able to lend to them, I long for them also to see or hear your story, because I'm sure they can just tell you as a person, clearly you care about them and you're sacrificing so they can farm. Now, it's also going to be reciprocal, because hopefully you and investors make money and all that kind of stuff. And hopefully if that doesn't happen, then it doesn't perpetuate itself. So I commend you. And, you know, those days when my knees hurt or my back hurts, you know, as you get older, it's like, knock it off. There's still so many things to be grateful for here.
Yeah. Keep that heart of gratitude. It's amazing what you'll find to be grateful for.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for sharing your story and who you are. For those, just don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital and your podcast, App of Choice. Till next time, Jeff Schaefer. Sharon, thanks again.
My pleasure.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.